That's the thing. I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but anytime they start fiddling with this stuff, like anytime the government starts making big changes like this, they inevitably create new loopholes. So there's new strategies and new ways around it. And so when we talked through the first bullet point, I was kind of like, oh, that's kind of cool. That's exciting because that's simple and it's going to be straightforward. But the more bullet points we have on this thing, it's just going to add new strategies into the mix. So, you know, there's going to be, we still have to see how it shakes out.
Welcome to Finance for Physicians, the show where we help physicians like you use money as a tool to live a great life. I'm your host, Daniel Rinn, and I've spent the last decade advising physicians on their personal finances with the mission to help them understand that taking control of their finances now means creating a future where they can practice medicine where, when, and how long they want to.
Jeff, what's going on, man?
Daniel. The world is blowing up again.
Didn't we just were talking and I think what I said was, I hope we don't have to get back and talk about student loans again soon and that everything stays more consistent and predictable, something along those lines. Yet here we are, we're going to be talking about some student loan hot news.
That's so right.
This is big time stuff though. We'll try to get this show out pretty quick too, because so we're recording, it's May 1st, but this is new stuff. It's actually, as we're speaking, it's still in the, this is some student loan changes that are getting proposed. I'll let you kind of give us the layout, Jeff. So maybe break it down what we're going to talk about and we'll jump into it.
Yeah. So I think maybe we should preface this with right now, everything that we're going to talk about is proposed. It is not. It has not happened. It's not in place and is certainly subject to some changes here.
Or completely being tossed out.
Or none of it could happen, yeah. But at this point, so the House GOP Education Committee has actually released their proposed text that would overhaul a lot of student loan programs or student loan parts of the student loan system based on this budget reconciliation that would be going through Congress. And so it's not a nothing burger. It's not one senator or one House of Representative, one representative proposing something. It is from the House GOP Education Committee and is part of what that bill will go to for the spending bill to go to the Senate. But there are a lot of changes that impact student loans and PSLF in there right now.
Yes. Jeff and I were just talking about it before we hit record, and I was very surprised at how much change they're proposing. And I mean, yeah, like we said, this is definitely not set in stone. It's definitely more than just like a politician said this is an idea or Trump said something was an idea. This is like kind of like phase two in that it's been ironed out to some extent and now they have to start fine-tuning it. So they do have to get votes and agree on it and pass it in both, you know, the House and the Senate. So there's quite a bit left. And then the president has, I would assume the president signs it. But yeah, lots of big changes. So it's good to kind of have this on the radar. That's the main reason we want to share with you guys, is just so people have it on the radar. We'll share more details as they come out. So what do you think is the biggest change? There's a few. So we're going to hit like four or five of the big bullet points we think are most relevant, but what do you think is number one, the biggest change?
There are a lot of big ones in here. I'd say probably the first one, it both answers and causes maybe a little tension for the current student loan payment plans, but some changes going on there with the actual plan options available. So I think the first thing would be the payment plans. The proposal here is that basically, we've been worried about the SAVE plan or talking about the SAVE plan and what happens to that. This proposal has basically every current payment plan, pay as you earn, payee, new IBR, so income-based repayment, SAVE, ICR, income contingent repayment, all of those would transition to the old IBR plan.
Or the original IBR.
Yes, the original, the OG IBR. from back when Daniel said he was in student loans, man, yeah. In 2010. Back then, how many plans were there?
The one. That was the one. Well, I guess ICR was around. I don't know. Nobody ever did ICR.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to, but.
But IBR was the option, the only option, really. And that was, a PSLF existed then, too. So originally, that was the whole structure, is it was old IBR, or it was IBR at that time. And then whether or not you do PSLF, it qualified for it. So essentially, it sounds like they're just transitioning back to the original OG PSLF structure.
Yes. And so everybody that's on those plans would be transitioned to that original structure as part of that that proposition. Mm. Daniel, what would that mean for, what would that do to most people's payments? Is it a good thing, a bad thing?
I have no idea. I mean, and when I start thinking about scenarios, I have no idea, because there's a lot of questions that are probably unanswered yet, not answered yet. But like, generally speaking, it would increase them. But like, I could come up with a scenario. I'm wondering, like, let's say somebody did the Save plan have a cap?
No, Save plan had no cap.
Yeah. So Save, well, Save doesn't, Save's in jeopardy either way. But if I say I was on the Save plan, so it has no cap and I have an ultra high income, IBR was capped out at 10-year standard payment. So I have no idea how that's going to work, because are they going to just say you're unable to get into new IB or old IBR because your income is so high? That's a question I'm sure we don't have the answer to. So, but if they did still allow you into old IBR, in theory, your payment could go down quite a bit, you know, relative to what it would have been in Save. But yeah,
that would be like the magic answer for several, you know, a lot of people with a Save plan and not sure if they can get on to another income-based repayment or income-driven repayment plan.
Yeah, that could be a good thing. That could be a really good thing. But yeah, no, for the majority of people, it's going to mean quite a bit higher payments. Are they using I know they're changing some of the formula stuff. Are they using the same, for this one, are they using the same standard, like income minus the poverty threshold times 15%?
Yeah, so the IBR would be, remain unchanged. So that'd be the formula for it. It's 15%.
Same formula as the original IBR.
After taking away that protected income, which that always gets confusing, but it's a benefit to borrowers when you take away that income, at least for the payment calculation.
Yeah, it's basically income minus poverty threshold, 150% of poverty threshold. And your poverty threshold changes based on the size of your family and sometimes the state that you live in. So that's where it gets complicated. But they do the math for you when you do it. But the big thing is it's 15%. So a payee is 10%. New IBR is 10%. Save is, I don't even know. I mean, it's 10%-ish.
10% for most of our audience, yeah.
Yeah. So 10% versus 15, that's a huge, pretty substantial difference.
Yes. Well, 50%. Payment might go up 50% or get to the cap. So I think that would be what you might expect, would be your payment's going to go up for most people if that were to occur.
But then I don't know if they let you in if you're over the cap, though. That's a question, because they might technically, to enter into that, like back in the day, back in the OG PSLF days when there was just IBR, you couldn't just get into IBR. Like if you had a really high income, you couldn't get into it. If you're above the threshold, you couldn't get into it. So I don't know if they bring that back or not, but that could cause problems. But
yeah, I don't have the language of it memorized yet. My understanding is that basically everyone would get transitioned to IBR, which would be a good off-ramp for whatever other plan you're on. You know, that'll at least, we'll have to see how the mechanics of that would work again. Or if they do apply that, you know, partial financial hardship criteria where you have to be able to actually benefit from the income-driven plan to get on it. So we'll see.
Yeah. So bad news is, if this does play out, there's probably a lot of you guys listening that are going to see big, decent-sized payment increases. Also, the other bad news with this is, if you're going for the 20-year or 25-year forgiveness, everybody gets switched to 25 years, right, Jeff?
Right. Yeah. So on pay as you earn or a new IBR, right? You can get your loans forgiven after 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But IBR, the old IBR, what everybody would switch to is only 25 years. That's not the PSLF. That's just regular old forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Not as enticing, but valuable for some.
Good news is that, potentially good news is that IBR could offer a payment cap that could be helpful. And so if you have the qualifying issues because your income is really high with Safe Plan, especially, it could allow you potentially to transition into IBR without, you know, you could essentially get back into qualifying for PSLF. And that's the other good news too, is that it's qualifying. So IBR qualifies for PSLF. So they're not canon PSLF.
Well, I think one big benefit of this that you mentioned off camera earlier was just we're down to one plan now, right?
Oh, the simplification. That's a big benefit.
Yeah, like we don't have 5 or 12 or a million plans to choose from. It's IBR. Does that work for you or not? And you know, yep. You don't have to do all the mental gymnastics.
Yeah, right. When I was looking at it in 2010 and all in that time frame, it was pretty straightforward. It was still complicated. I mean, there were some complicating factors. Like, I think you can still do married filing separately. Mm-hmm. The payment cap and projecting payments was always complicated because they got all the poverty calculations and they're confusing. But and at the time, I remember thinking it was complicated. But then when they added repay, payee, Safe Plan, new IBR, forbearance during COVID, and all these buyback programs and blah, 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 then it just blew up. It was like exponentially more complicated. So that is a big benefit to the masses, I guess. When you complicate things, it's a big advantage for the people that are like, I guess, in the know or can afford advice. So, but for the overall population, it's definitely, I would say it favors the average kind of person when it's simpler. So that's a plus.
So they propose simplifying it by taking away all the plans. And then the next bullet point we had was they want to add a new plan.
I know. Well, Jeff explained this first bullet point to me before we started. I was like, that sounds great. It's simple. And then he's like, yeah, and they're adding a plan. So
yeah. So taking away all the options and then adding another one.
I don't like this one.
Yes. Well, I mean, you kind of do. I mean, you like,
I mean, I like it, but I don't. I don't like the simple, the complicating factor, but break it down for us.
Yeah. So the proposal introduces a new repayment plan called the Repayment Assistance Plan, or the RAP. That's why I thought Daniel would like it, because
I do like to RAP.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we got to get one of our other team members in here to lay down a beat for us for the repayment assistance plan.
That's an inside joke, by the way. Sorry, you guys don't get it.
Yes. Oh, well, all right. But anyway, this plan, it's actually kind of complicated, kind of not. For our audience, it's going to be 10% of AGI is what you're going to pay. If you're earning under $100,000, you get a sliding scale of 1 to 10% of your adjusted gross income. So that's...
So in training, that would be advantageous.
Certainly advantageous in training.
Does it qualify for PSLF?
And I believe it should. If it's an IDR plan, it should qualify. I have to double check. Again, I don't have... It's new. I haven't memorized the language yet, but...
What?
I know. Working high expectations, on. But I... Yeah, we'll keep reading through it and understand it better and better as we go, but... If it's a new IDR plan, PSLF should count it. The difference here is it's going to be a higher 10% payment than any of the payments that we've expected or we've worked on so far with the pays you earn or anything like that. Because Daniel, you made reference to that protected income level. So under all of these old plans that we've had, you take your income basically from your tax return. And then you subtract a certain portion of the poverty level. Mm-hmm. And then you calculate the payment. So it's 10% of that. So it's not 10% of your actual income. It's 10% of your income minus some. This one would just be 10% of your income or whatever that percentage is if you are on that sliding scale. But no deduction for poverty level. There is a small deduction for dependents, but nothing like the poverty level deduction. So that's part one. You know, it is a simpler plan probably to calculate for yourself. You can still file separately and only have it count your income. So that's a good thing when we're talking, in most cases, when we're thinking about strategizing for PSLF. And then it also offers forgiveness. So if you have a balance remaining after 30 years, that balance would be forgiven as part of this plan. It's going to be unlikely that many people have a balance after 30 years based on this payment structure. But, you know, certainly if you have low income, it's possible. Maybe you got a degree and then you became a stay-at-home spouse. That could factor into that too, something like that. So there's that forgiveness option. And then it does have an interest subsidy as well, very similar to the SAVE plan, where if you had unpaid interest on the payment you're making, it goes away, poof, vanishes. So it's not accruing. So that's
like in training, it would that. And it did you say it counts for PSLF? It does, doesn't it?
It does. It would. It's an IDR plan. It would count for. But
all right,
don't want to pull away the curtain on the other changes.
My strategic mind is already thinking. I'm like thinking that.
So yes, it would count. Why don't we skip ahead to a PSLF for residents and fellows, though?
Oh yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
the plan should count for PSLF.
Forgot about that.
However, PSLF would have some changes to the criteria of what counts as qualifying employment a little bit. So not a little bit for our audience, a major change. And why don't you tell us that one, Daniel?
All right. So they're proposing that residency and fellowship would no longer count. And I don't know how they're defining that exactly. If they're just explicitly saying residency or fellowship, or are they saying training, or I don't know. I'd be curious to see exactly how they're wording that. I guess the most direct scenario or worst case scenario would be that it explicitly says residency and fellowship. You know, physician's training and residency or fellowship does not count towards PSLF credit. So that's a bummer, because historically that's been a home run. So, you know, if you're a physician making $1 million a year and you're at a hospital that's happens to be nonprofit and you go through 8 years of training, you're going to pay a tiny fraction of your student loans back, even though you're going to be making $1 million a year. So I am sure that's probably what they're trying to get rid of. And you can imagine why they would be targeting that, at least based on the intent of the program in the beginning. It was like intended for, it was kind of a social program. It was intended to stimulate public service jobs and like intended for lower paying positions, and hence the income-based aspect and the fact that it was public service focused. But there's always loopholes. That's the thing. I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but anytime they start fiddling with this stuff, like anytime the government starts making big changes like this, they inevitably create new loopholes. So there's new strategies and new ways around it. And so when we talked through the first bullet point, I was kind of like, oh, that's kind of cool. That's exciting, because that's simple and it's going to be straightforward. But the more bullet points we have on this thing, it's just going to add new strategies into the mix. So, you know, there's going to be, we still have to see how it shakes out. But yes, at this point, it's looking like the proposal is that no residency or fellowship time or payments would count towards PSLF at all.
Let's take a quick break to talk about our firm, Renda Financial Planning. The goal of our podcast is to empower you to make better financial decisions. But sometimes the best financial decision you can make is to work with someone who understands your financial goals and has the expertise to keep you on track to reach them. That's where Renda Financial Planning comes in. We are a full-service financial planning firm that works with over 400 physicians and their families across the country. We charge a transparent monthly flat fee for our services and offer virtual meetings you can take from anywhere. Best of all, you'll get to work with a team that specializes in working with physician families. So whether you're starting out and wondering how you'll balance your student loan payments and saving for a home, or You are an established physician trying to figure out how to pay for your kid's college and how much you need to save to reach financial freedom? We can help. I'll put a link in the show notes to schedule a no obligation meeting with one of our certified financial planners. Wren Financial Planning, LLC is a registered investment advisor. For more information about our firm, please visit WrenFinancial.com. That's WRENNE Financial.com.
I wonder if they keep the forbearance option available still. There's currently still a forbearance option for residents and fellows. So if they do keep that, that's just going to be way more popular. And I
would imagine, so I don't think that's even addressed. So I would imagine that would be a provision that would stick around.
And then if you do enter a repayment during training, I think that's just going to make the wrap plan pretty popular consideration too. Cause if you're making less than 100, it's like, well,
yeah, if you can afford the payment, whatever that payment sliding scale is, how that applies to you, cause you won't be charged the interest then, right? In forbearance, you have interest, but.
This is also a home run. If this goes through, this is a home run for student loan refinance companies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think Daniel's got a reason that that's going to be a really big home run, not just for refinance, but for lenders in general.
Yes.
Yay, go big banks, right? We love them. But before we get there, the way this is proposed, so if you are already in med school, have started med school, and up until starting med school in 2026 or after is who this would affect. So if you're currently a resident, this would still grandfather you in. So guess you don't have to lose your mind, just your friends and that's colleagues coming up will. But
yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. That is super important.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are not grandfathered in here. Like every proposal pretty much that we've seen in the past keeps all the old payment plans and just adds its own spin.
Yeah.
Grandfather's in. If you had your plan, you can stay on your plan. So there are things that are definitely not grandfathered, but current residents, current fellows, current med school students would still be gaining that credit for residency and fellowship. Yeah.
The people that are going to lose it if this goes through are the ones you said
entering the fall of 2026. So,
or after. So entering residency in the fall of 2026 or later.
I believe it is
medical
school. Med school. So med school.
Okay. So there's going to be a pretty good batch of people that are.
Yeah. Still doesn't apply to right now. So I think.
Yeah. So if I'm like a sophomore, if I'm second year medical student, I'm good.
You should be good under this proposal. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's better. Okay. So the last big one this is the last one, right?
Yeah, I think the last one, probably the biggest overall, like, I don't know, just theoretical policy standpoint is actually there's a lot of pros and possibly cons to it. But that would be that professional school borrowing would actually be capped at $150,000, not per year total. Okay. So
inflation adjusted, hopefully.
No.
No,
right now it's not. So that's
bring that in there.
You know, we have right now, you know, the cost of med school, the cost of dental school is certainly higher than that. But maybe, Daniel, what do you think the intent of this might be? So I think there's definitely an argument. There's some good intent for why we'd want a cap on borrowing. Because right now we have no cap on graduate borrowing.
Yeah.
You can take out an unlimited amount.
Well, yeah, we can do pros and cons. Or I can play both sides of this coin. But like on the pro side, supply and demand. So like when you have unlimited borrowing potential, federal borrowing is particularly key because they have zero underwriting. They're like, sign here, you get the loan. If you're in professional school, sign here, you get the loan. There's no like financial qualification. Like they don't check your credit. You could be a train wreck. You could have a zillion credit cards. You still get the loan. So it's very easy. Well, I mean, I don't know if easy is the right word. Yeah, I guess it's very easy to qualify for unlimited professional school loans federally. I think there are some caps, but they're extremely high. And so what happens when you have a really high borrowing caps, especially when they're federal loans, is, or anytime you make something easier to buy, because this is a purchase ultimately, you're buying education. So anytime you make anything, you make access to money to buy things easier, it increases demand for that, which for when you're looking at supply and demand, economics, that kind of thing, when you keep the supply the same and increase demand, the price goes up. Basic economics. So the economics professor, well, I don't know. I would think they would argue that a big factor in why tuition is so high, especially for professional schools, is because of these super lenient lending standards for the federal government, for federal student loans over the past, you know, however long it's been around, years. And that's been when the prices have gone up over that period of time. So the argument is that this, well, if I'm taking the economic standpoint, the argument would be that by putting a cap in it, you're going to put a cap on that supply aspect of funds available, which should start to get the price more in check. I mean, if we really wanted to see what market price was for college, we would eliminate student loans, because then that's just going to be a pure free market, I guess. It's just going to make it much harder to find capital or dollars or supply. It's going to affect supply. But this is like a step in that direction. It's like, let's see if we can reduce prices of tuition. Now, this is kind of like theoretical, you know, economics theory. But I can talk about the other side of the argument too, or you can talk about it if you want. Maybe you could talk about it.
I don't know what side of the screen we're on. Are we on the right or the left? Am I on the right and you're on the left? Just jokingly which side we're taking here, right? But I guess to sum that up, so basically you have unlimited access to money to fund your graduate school degree. The schools then have very little incentive to reduce costs because they can always point you to, well, you have the option to borrow. Like, you can't get the financing to come here. It's okay. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Yeah. I mean, and it's supply demand too, you know, because when there's more, it's that part, the school doesn't have incentive to, I mean, they have incentive to raise prices always. Well, most of the time, but also there's plenty of people willing to go to school because they have such a free act, they're so easy access to money. So those two factors make it prone to have price increases.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So I think maybe the con or the flip side to that is the maybe the social aspect of it that you kind of referenced with some of the other points we had too, is just the actual access to these schools or to, you know, a medical degree. To be a dentist, to be a physician, potentially that would be actually limiting, you know, who can even attend if you can't get the financing to go there. If it's does that limit it to only people with the resources to pay for it? So that's the con, possibly,
right?
Or the argument against there that if be an issue.
If you didn't agree with the economics argument I was just talking about, or you thought it wasn't going to be very substantial, like maybe you agree with it kind of, but you're like, yeah, I get you. But like when they lower when they make it harder to get money, the schools are only going to lower their tuition some, like just a little bit. If that's your stance, then the result potentially is that a bunch of people can't afford it. And there's already a physician shortage and whatever. And so it's only going to get amped up worse. It's going to get way worse because there's just not going to be, it's already difficult to be a doctor. And that's just going to make it impossible for some people. So, but now going back, flip-flopping on both sides. On the, going back to the economic side, the schools have to have students, you know, like they're running a business. So they're going to have to, it's going to kind of force change if that does play out. So they'll have to, that's just going to be an inevitable consequences. If like they couldn't let their, like medical schools couldn't let their tuition numbers go down even, I would think, 10%. Like, because that's just going to be a huge hit to their bottom line, even if they kept tuition the same. So they're going to have to come up. It's, I think what it would do is it would force these schools to come up with a new way of doing business. And I don't know what the outcome would be. I know that they would have to come up with a new way of doing it if they made a big change to the standards on lending. So I'm super curious. This is, to me, this one's I'm the most curious about. I'm curious to see how it would shake out. Oh, and the other thing too is, I was mentioning this earlier, if I'm a private student loan lender, I'm like cheering this baby on. I'm like, this is going to be great for business, because they've always been in the background, like as the, you know, alternative to public, to federal student loans. It's like, if Bank of America, all of them are going to be like, there's already a bunch of private student loan lenders, but everybody's going to be getting into that game, because they're going to be like, well, we'll give you money. We're just going to make you do underwriting. They're not going to just hand it out to everybody. They're going to be like, here's the standards check you have to do. You're going to have to verify your, I don't know, citizenship, maybe even it might be hard for international students. And then like credit check, they're not going to want to lend to people that can't make their credit card payments, that kind of thing. Would be more common.
Yeah. So what I hear, the point would be, that I hear is, you know, there are willing lenders ready to step in and take on a lot of that. Like SoFi would love your business, I think.
Right. Well,
Mohila's SoFi, public arms, right? They, whatever, all those things that funnel into Mohila, they SoFi, would love your business.
SoFi and those guys, they're loving this already, even before we mentioned this last point, because what's going to happen is it's going to force people to refinance out of, away from PSLF. They're like, if I'm a resident, I'm like, now I'm paying 15% and they're not going to cover training, I'm refinancing because they're charging me 7%. So everybody, you know, it's going to increase the volume of refinancing away from federal loans. Plus they're, if they do pass this professional school cap, it's going to increase the level of private loan lending. So there's refinancing and there's new loans. I think that would just amp up the number of private student loans going out, which yeah, could, you know, conflict with the thing we were just talking about with the free markets. You know, it may be that tuition stays the same because of that.
Yeah. So I think it's, I wish this was as simple as going down to one repayment plan too.
I know.
But I think there will be an impact where there are some that cannot get the financing that they would need. Mm. That would. At the same time, the hope is that it would also reduce the cost of education. And so, and then you have the lenders in the middle that are like, yeah, well, maybe they still prop up the cost of education.
Right.
So, well, it'll be interesting. But the impact there being that bullet point of $150,000 of federal total lending for graduate school. That's a big change.
Huge. Yeah. That's definitely not enough. If at the current rates, obviously, that cover, like, I don't know. What is the, I wonder what the average cost is of, I think the average medical student's coming out with $250,000, something like that, federal loans.
Yeah, in that range.
It's about $100,000 short.
Yes. But to recap all of that, there are a lot of changes in this proposed bill that is, you know, it's on its way to the Senate to then have the Senate reconcile. They propose their own changes to it. So nothing that's in here is has happened.
They'll go back and forth. There's going to be changes. There will for sure be changes, and they're going to whittle things down, or they'll be like, we got to add inflation to the 150,000, or we needed that to be 200,000 or whatever. That's normally how it goes.
Yeah. So we would expect to see changes. But I think those examples are very realistic ones would be, now that lending, that limit's too low. And
yeah,
we need to have inflation with it, or else we have to update this every single year, or every couple of years.
I wish you could ask us for input.
Yeah. But yeah, expect there to be changes from this, things to be thrown out, things to be added and updated. And probably when you were talking about going between the House and the Senate, for there to be not. So consider this like the most extreme option that's proposed right now. and to expect it to not be as extreme in some respect, whether that's lending limits or grandfathering in more things or whatnot. But
yeah, we'll see. I mean, I guess you never know. It could get thrown out completely, or it could get more, become more extreme. It's just, that's unlikely both ways. But yeah, right now it's looking like it'll probably end up, something will shake out and it's probably going to be pretty major, and it probably will be watered down from this, but who knows in what direction.
Yeah. So I guess
we'll keep
action items.
Nothing. No, stay tuned is the action item.
Stay tuned.
Cause you don't want to do too much until this thing gets passed. As soon as it gets passed though, that's when it's game time. We'll go to the drawing board to start strategizing.
Yeah, actually, so you're right. I think with your student loan, nothing here is real yet. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing's changed. If you're passionate about this, it is right now the time when these budgets are being sent back and forth. If you're passionate about it one way or the other, you could contact your representative or your senator, though, and let them know your opinion.
There you go. That's a good one.
And then you won't change your student loans right now, but it may change. It may have an impact on policy. So.
Yeah, and especially if you have, I mean, well, you could contact your senator, I think probably senator or the House, but especially senator, either way. But like, especially if you have a really good case, I guess, like you, and they do take that into consideration. So that's a good point. I wasn't thinking about that.
It's always good
to have an action item.
Yeah, so I think that's one, and it's one that you can do whatever your view is. Cause I think there are all of these from one side or the other, there are pros and cons to everything in here. There's silver linings and negatives, but and you might be passionate about one versus the other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Get your voice heard. Yep. Tell your representative or your senator what you think about it. Or if you feel like, you know, your student loans, you agreed to the pay as you were in payment plan and it's going away. Be like, hey, I signed up for this. It was promised to me and you want it back. Let them know that too. Whatever it might be.
Yeah. Here's my promissory note. You see my signature here.
Tell them you signed that you read it. So if they could also read it and keep what was in there, that would be appreciated.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. Well, that was a goofy end. But yeah, talk to your representative if you have anything.
Yep. All right. Well, we'll keep you guys posted as we learn more. Jeff, thanks for coming on to update us on the student loan chaos.
Of course. What a ride.
I'm sure we'll have to be talking about this soon.
We'll see you then.
All right.
No guests or clients appearing on the podcast received any form of compensation for their appearance and obtained no other benefit from us. It should not be assumed that every client has had the same experience.